This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson. If you're anything like me, you have been spending a few minutes or hours each day trying to listen to Cowboy Carter, the new album from Beyoncé. Some people say this is a country album by a hip-hop artist. She says it's a Beyoncé album, which I think means for her, she's just a musician. But I think it's impossible for us as a culture to think about or talk about this without getting to the history of segregation and race and music and what it means in 2024.
I haven't fully listened to the album. I've heard songs, but what I've heard sounds good. And I've only heard good things about it from other folks, too.
So I brought this to the show's producer, Carey Jr. II, saying, hey, I want to talk about this. I want to find somebody who will be able to kind of lead us through all of these layers of race and history and music and help us make sense of what Beyoncé's doing and how we should be thinking about it.
But when I heard that she was going to release this album and that people were like, oh, after Texas Hold'em, I think, was the single, and everyone was like, oh, she's going to release a country album, I was thinking, oh, okay, well, Beyoncé and country together sounds like almost like a reclamation of what country music has been.
Right.
Because black folks have been a part of the history of country music.
He shared some of his ideas for where we might go with this conversation, and I shared some of mine. I think it was bold of her to say up front, it's just a Beyoncé album. Mm-hmm. Don't even think about it in terms of genre. Mm-hmm. But of course, she had to know that once it got out, people were going to put it in a genre and talk about why it belongs in that genre or doesn't. Talk about why she should be recording in that genre or shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like for me, when I saw the way that she put it together and the covers that she did, a way to really elevate the sounds and the artists and the voices of country music, I thought about that being her method in reclaiming it, right? I thought that it harkens back in my head to how black artists have been inspiring genres all throughout history.
Yes.
And so I really, you know, when we first were going to talk about this, wanted to talk about or at least explore what that method, sampling, covering, interpolating meant in the context of this. But, you know, our conversation kind of goes.
It goes because because you can't talk about any of these things in isolation.
All over the
place. They don't exist in isolation. Mm-hmm. They spill over into everything else. And we landed with Dan Charnas, who's an academic and an author. He literally wrote the book on J. Dilla, one of the greatest producers in hip-hop who is from here in the city of Detroit. He's someone I turn to pretty frequently when I want to talk about music and ownership and history and race and genre. Okay, Dan Charnas, welcome to Created Equal.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and of course we have Carey Jr. II, the show's producer, in the studio for this because he loves music too.
Yay.
And he's got thoughts about sampling and borrowing and compensation and the history of that. Carey, great to have you in the studio.
I'm excited to have this conversation.
Okay, guys, so I want to start with something that's just in the news. Now, Beyoncé has this new album out that I think touches on a lot of the things that we want to think about here in this conversation. Cowboy Carter is really deeply inspired by country music. And in fact, it is drawing on a lot of country music. There are a lot of country artists who appear on the album. Their music appears. But then it also cast forward in the way that it includes black artists who are performing now. And I think in a way it's kind of full circle, right? Like there is this evolution, I think, of the way in which music borrows from other music and then pushes it forward. And of course, it's not without controversy because of our history and discrimination and racism and all those kind of things. But there's I think, an opportunity with Beyoncé doing what she's doing to stop and think about what all that means and how all of that frames the way we should be thinking about borrowing, about sampling, about compensation, and all those things. So, Dan, I want to start with you just reacting to what Beyoncé has done here and tell us what it means in some ways.
Well, I think one of the facts that is sort of lost on most folks, except for those like me who teach American popular music history, is that, you know, the business of the record business and the music business was born during Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what we think of as genre was essentially shaped by Jim Crow practices and thinking, but isn't necessarily the actual contour of music. And what I mean by that is, in the early part of the, you know, history of the record business, let's say the 1910s, 1920s, there emerged this idea of a genre called hillbilly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another designation for music that was performed by black artists that they called race music.
Race
and that
music
might include rag, that might include blues, that might include jazz. But the fact of the matter is, musically speaking, the differences could often be very, very slender, if non-existent. For example, the country music industry, the hillbilly, you know, lineage traces itself back to something that is commonly called the Big Bang of country music, which was, I believe, 1926, 1927, when a A&R, you know, talent scout slash producer for Victor Records did a recording session, a massive recording session in Bristol, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And on the sort of same either it was the day or weekend or whatever sojourn this was, he recorded two towering icons of the country music business. You could think of this as the four fathers and four mothers, right? The Carter family on the one hand, and Jimmy Rogers on the other.
Yeah.
Jimmy Rogers' first 12 songs for Victor were called Blue Yodels. Blue Yodel number one, Blue Yodel number two, Blue Yodel number three, and so forth. Those songs are called Blue Yodels because they are the blue. They are blues songs.
Yeah.
They are structured as 12-bar blues, 1-4-5. And Blue Yodel number nine features Louis Armstrong and Lil Hardin on trumpet and piano, respectively, which is not only miscegenation, right, for the time period, but really throws the lie to a lot of this segregatory impulse.
Yeah, wow.
But so these categories are fluid, and let's not forget that country music itself, when we think about country music, the iconic instrument of country music is the banjo. The banjo is from West Africa.
Yes.
So, you know, I think Jim Crow shaped a lot of what we think of as genre, and we have as a society and in the industry, never quite outrun those fallacies that come back to haunt us in every generation. And so now, to answer your question, what has Beyoncé done? I think Beyoncé has done what a lot of young black artists have been doing over the past decade or two, is really helping to reveal that lie. It's just that Beyoncé does it in this huge show business, mass market way that, you know, other country artists, black country artists, have not quite been able to do as she has done.
It's interesting because I feel like black country artists, when they come out with music, they almost, at least in my perception growing up, seemed like a token artist in the industry.
Right.
And so I think what's important about what you're saying, Dan, is that Black people have been there since its inception. They've been crucial towards its development. And what she's doing is just kind of re-owning that, right? Reclaiming that and staking, like, we are a part of this genre. And doing it in her own way, of course. And as Stephen alluded to, bringing up newer Black country artists in the same vein. It's a lot of pieces going on at the same time, which I think is kind of interesting for this dialogue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, look, I just you know, as you know, I wrote this book on Dilla, mm-hmm. you know, which has a lot to do with the history of Black Detroit. And Dilla's grandmother, Mabel, her favorite music was country music. She grew up listening to the Grand Ole Opry broadcasts mm-hmm. yeah. out of Nashville. So there's nothing not Black about country music.
Yeah.
It's right. just been twisted and denuded. And shaped in ways that, in the same way that the American flag has,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But there's something about what Beyoncé's doing that also seems different to me from what you might see from the kind of meager Black presence that's already in country music, right? Mm. So, I mean, you have some African American country recording artists, and they are, you know, some of them are more successful than others, but you know they're part of that genre. She's not, right? I mean, she is a superstar who, of course, transcends genre in some ways, but her roots are in R&B and hip hop. So when she says I'm going to make a country album, it's different than a Black artist saying, well, I'm a country performer.
Well, technically, she said she's going to make a Beyoncé album.
Well, that's right. That's right. She said.
She's going to make sure that was clear.
That's all she does, right? She's an industry in and of herself. But there's something mm-hmm. there's something distinct about the idea of her doing it. Mm-hmm. I think from even someone like Lil Nas X, who has mm-hmm. who had that popular kind of country song. I mean, there's something profound about it, Dan, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, there are folks who understandably see her as a carpetbagger or an interloper, mm-hmm. Sort of sucking the oxygen out of the room for people like Rhiannon Giddens and others,
yeah.
right,
mm-hmm.
who have been really trying to ply the same territory that, say, Charlie Pride did mm-hmm. in the 60s and 70s. But I tend not to look at it quite that way. I think that also that feeds the thought form that there can only be one.
Which is a long thing that
haunts Black Americans in almost every field of endeavor in America, mm-hmm. right, when talking about mainstream success. But I think that Beyoncé is actually making her own kind of statement that's very different from, say, hey, here's my country album. She's actually making an artistic political statement in a way that may be more artistic and maybe more egotistic than political, but still, you know, she's making it. And I think it's our responsibility in the first iteration or the first sort of glance to really address it for what it is rather than what it isn't.
So what's the statement she's making?
Well, I think it starts with you know, the album cover, right?
Yeah.
Danielle Smith said this on MSNBC sometime this week, and I think it bears repeating, is that people misinterpret her use of the American flag as some sort of sellout or a kowtowing to mainstream American sensibilities. But Beyoncé is saying in that photo what I've heard so many Black Americans say over years and years and years, like, I pay my taxes
right.
here. Mm-hmm. There is nobody more American than African Americans. There is nobody more American than, say, a Black Texan. And that's what Beyoncé's saying. This is mine. This isn't Trump's. This isn't white folks. We fought and bled for this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my right to hold it and make it mean
mm-hmm.
what it means to me. And then the music follows
right.
through from that in terms of her being able to jump between genres, to use some of the traditional instruments of country music, the traditional song forms, and yet go back and forth between them. To have a four on the floor, you know, house music beat underneath more, you know, countrified instruments. And frankly, nothing that country itself hasn't done. Country, we forget, as Charles Hughes pointed out in his incredible book, Country Soul, country had a disco phase.
Did. Yeah, right?
I'm not familiar with this.
Yo, we forget.
Well, and even now, country, I mean, disco? Look, I when I'm looking at YouTube or Instagram or Facebook and, you know, I get these reels, a lot of them are of white country fans line dancing in bars to music that is both country and hip hop, right? And the moves that they're doing are both these kind of contemporary line dance, the kind of thing that you would have seen country fans do, but also they're incorporating hip hop moves, right? Mm-hmm. Like the blackness of or the aspirational blackness, I guess, of that really suggests that country is kind of different than what a lot of people think it is.
Oh yeah,
I think it comes
absolutely.
To me, I think also what you're hitting on, Dan, is about Beyoncé kind of in the same vein as that American flag, propelling this genre forward and, like we said, uplifting these younger artists. And it's the way she does it, because there's some, like, I think 10 types of either samples or interpolations or covers on this album from previous country artists or songs that I think really kind of create the tapestry that she uses to do this. And it's the fact, for me at least, that she's taking that approach to doing this in her genre, which I think is a practice that we know has been popularized by black and hip-hop culture, on top of the fact that we know historically, as you ironed out earlier for us, that black artists weren't really a part of the country's narrative early on, right? We've kind of rewritten that. And so I feel like this is kind of her taking onus on that through this kind of approach. I'm curious to know, though, is there a reason in particular you think that that practice of bringing in these older songs and this older music might be, for me, it sounds like it's more popular than today, but it's maybe even done a little bit more intentional to kind of hark back to these specific times and make these specific messages that wasn't done before. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to do this song that no one's really heard of. I'm going to do a song I know people have heard of and do it intentionally.
I think Beyoncé's way, for example, of interpreting Jolene is a brilliant reinterpretation, as opposed to, say, when Miley Cyrus did it, it was more homage, right? More faithful to the original version. And I think that's great. I think that we need faithful covers. And it's funny, her cover of Blackbird was much more faithful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I swear to God, I thought that acoustic guitar was a sample of Paul McCartney playing. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so faithful, as opposed to Jolene, which is very funny and maybe indicative of Beyoncé's personality. She's never going to let herself not be top dog in any situation, you know, whether realistic or fictional, with another woman.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have more of this conversation with Dan Charnas and Cary Jr. II about music, sampling, compensation, borrowing, and history. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Dan Charnas, an author and professor, the person who wrote the book, literally, on Dilla, maybe the most famous music producer from hip-hop here in the city of Detroit. We've also got Carey Jr. II with us. He is the producer of Created Equal. We were talking in the previous segment about Beyoncé's use of sampling in her latest album. It is a different animal than what Black artists in particular have dealt with for a long time. And again, there's this the evolution of it does seem like it's kind of coming full circle again, and you know, it kind of over time layers back on itself and then goes in a different direction. But let's talk about what sampling is, whether you think it's okay, and how we should be thinking of justice, I guess, in the sense of when you borrow from somebody and their ideas.
Sure. Well, I think it's important that I begin with my own positionality with regard to this.
Yes.
As somebody who was in the music business for many years on the executive side, helping hip-hop artists become what they wanted to become. Obviously, hip-hop was built on this idea of sampling, but now as a teacher of popular music history, and somebody who teaches a course called Recycling Pop Music, mm-hmm. right? It's all mm-hmm. about the inextricable relationship between copying and creativity. Mm-hmm. James Webb Young, famous author and ad executive, wrote a book that essentially asserts that all ideas are the product of two previous ideas, mm-hmm. just a combination of two previous ideas. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that essentially to be true. I think that genres are like blues, you know, they share certain structures and chord progressions that are repeated and repeated and repeated mm-hmm. until they're changed, and then they become the basis of some other genre. So I don't believe that we live in some world where folks don't copy. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this very Eurocentric view of what composition is. You know, the wizened old white man with the powdered wig on, sitting in front of the piano with a little quill and etching out notes on music, on line music paper, as the inspiration comes from God. When in fact, so many of these classical composers were just borrowing melodies from folk tunes and things like that. So there is no beginning to this, just like each one of us have a mother and a father, right? All ideas have that too. So that's where I'm coming from with this. Mm. The other thing is we need to get our vocabulary and our terms straight.
Yeah, yeah.
There are actually two different things that one can own as far as what we call intellectual property in music. Mm-hmm. There's the song, right? Which is just essentially an idea of a certain order of chords and melody and perhaps lyrics on top of that. That's a song idea, a song, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the recording of that song, the recording of a performance of that song, which is the other thing that can be owned. So you can either own a song, mm-hmm. or a recording, or sometimes both, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or have a stake in, as an artist, usually, if you write your own songs, you own most or all or most or part of the publishing to that song, if you haven't sold a share of it, and you have a stake in the recording, usually a royalty stake, if mm-hmm. you don't own the masters outright. So
if I hear you,
with a song, when you take a piece of a song,
Dan, real quick, I have a question for clarification. No, you're good. For a song, is it healthy interpretation or example of that, like the sheet music? The sheet music has all the notes and the lyrics on it, but it's not the recording itself. It's what you would use to make the recording, but the rights are like what's on the sheet music.
Correct. In other mm-hmm. words, when the music business started, there were no records. It was just the sheet music business.
Right.
And so what was copyrightable was this song idea fixed in form.
Got it.
Right? That's what you copyright. And it's a series of notes and a series of chords and maybe some lyrics, mm-hmm. right? So, for a song, if you take a piece of that song and use it in some way, it's called interpolation.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a piece of a recording, in our common terminology, that's called sampling, although there were antecedents to both of these things. So that's what I want to get really clear on mm-hmm. here, is that what Beyoncé is doing, we're not really talking about her sampling. And mm-hmm. as far as I know, we're really not talking about her interpolating too much. She's actually just re-recording entire songs. And that's enshrined in our copyright law with something called the compulsory license, meaning that Congress has decided that there needs to be a balance between absolute ownership and absolute chaos,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that you want to be able to profit off of your invention, whether it's a patent or a copyright, but you can't hold that tight forever, otherwise you stifle creativity.
Right.
So the compulsory license is a way to say, hey, if you write a song, you have the right to perform it and record it first. But mm-hmm. once that's done, you can't keep anybody else from re-recording it as long as they pay you the statutory rate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that Beyoncé's doing with Jolene. That's something that Beyoncé's doing with Blackbird. And that's not only common, but perfectly legal, and should be nothing controversial about it for me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
the people who own the rights to the song and the recordings are the ones who get the compensation from Beyoncé in this example, right?
Of course.
For her to perform / write these yeah. songs.
And sometimes are encouraging her to do it, like Dolly Parton said, right. I wish she would.
And Dolly's on the record, no less, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, of course, the history of this, though, is more fraught, right? I mean, this is the way it works now, and Beyoncé is following the law and the rules. But if you go back 50, 60, 70 years, and, of course, layer the history of racism and segregation on top of it, this was pretty ugly business.
Well, can we talk specific examples? Because I think there's a sense, and this is the sense that I got from our pre-interview as well,
yeah.
that this is where the injustice lies,
uh-huh.
and I'm not sure that the injustice lies in copying.
Okay.
The injustice lies in theft, right? So in other words, let me give you an example. This is a very common thing I see on social media. Elvis stole Hound Dog
right.
from Big Mama Thornton.
Okay.
There is truth to that, and there is BS to that. Here, let's talk to the BS first,
okay.
right? Mm-hmm. That isn't Big Mama Thornton's song. It's a song written by two Jewish guys named Lieber and Stoller.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Mama Thornton recorded the first version of that for a label called Peacock, which was one of the rare black-owned record labels in the 1950s. Don Roby, think of him as the Suge Knight of his day, didn't pay Big Mama Thornton for 500,000 units sold, and didn't pay the songwriters either.
Wow.
He didn't pay his artist. He didn't pay his songwriters. Everybody lost. Somehow, Elvis got it into his mind to re-record that song. Lieber and Stoller got paid because it's their song.
Right.
Big Mama Thornton did not get paid.
She's on the record.
Because it's not her performance.
Mm.
But the truth of that is that an artist like Elvis will always have more access and thus more equity in a system that is essentially based in Jim Crow.
Right,
mm-hmm. right.
I see.
Elvis can get played on pop stations because he's white, top 40 stations back then, whereas Big Mama Thornton, they would never even think of putting her or her version on a top 40 station. So now there may be cases in which black songwriters have written things and gotten their publishing essentially taken from them via negotiation.
Right.
Not been credited for things. But that's different than saying copying or cover songs are a problem.
Sure.
Right? So there's a What I'm asking us to do in this mm-hmm. conversation is have some requisite nuance for the subject.
Yeah.
So then what about black artists who've written songs that were then re-recorded? They were paid for that song, but at a smaller number than the amount of money was made once it was re-recorded as a whiter song. And it's not necessarily the fact that they weren't paid, but like if the percentage is minimal compared to how much they made off of that song, I think there's some understanding. I think that, wait a minute, this song is much bigger. You chose to promote this artist over another. I agree that there is some systemic racism baked into why that decision is made, but there's also some financial cost to it if that song was originally at least someone else's conception.
Well, the first thing I want to ask you is there a specific example or examples that come to mind?
The only example that comes to mind for me right now is The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
Yeah.
It was written by, I think it was a South African artist, not even a black American artist, South African artist. And
right.
they were paid, from what I saw in the reporting, like $2 for the song to be written. Once it was re-recorded by a whiter artist and translated into English, they made much more money off of it.
All right, well, I would have to literally re-familiarize myself with the specifics of the case. But what can often happen to artists mm-hmm. is that they can be approached by shady operators who say, I will buy your song outright
mm-hmm.
for whatever money. And then they no longer have rights,
right.
writer's share of that song, right? It's just gone. Or somebody could just not pay them, right? I could do a publishing agreement as a writer with a publisher, and I'm supposed to get my 50% share, and the publisher keeps their 50% share. But what happens is the publisher just doesn't pay. That's very common. And of course, it would be more common for black artists than white artists. It would mm-hmm. be more common for poor, unlawyered artists than for artists of better means
right.
And more access. So again, that is a problem of deceit, fraud, and business.
I see.
Not a problem of cover songs and copying, for which there are legal processes that must and should be followed.
But doesn't that still fuel a level of kind of resentment, I'd say,
mistrust.
Towards the industry or mistrust
yeah.
and feeling as if you are owed something from that history? I mean, I know that there is no way to compensate those individual artists or maybe their families because of the legal guidelines, but I think the feeling of it and the idea that nowadays artists, like, well, at least this is for me, like artists when Beyonce does something like this, it's almost like might be using this incorrectly, like a cultural reparations in a way of saying, hey, we're going to take back ownership of, not ownership, but take charge and put our stake in something that we know we've been a part of, that we've been cornered out of, and there's some financial cost to that historically, given rock and roll. But now I'm going to put on new artists, give them more exposure, now that I have the platform that the artists back then didn't have. So no, they're not directly asking these industries to pay them money, or she's not directly asking a record label to pay an older artist. But it's almost like using her power nowadays to kind of reframe the dynamics.
Well, look, now we're elevating the discussion, though.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about cover
yeah.
songs
yeah.
and compensation. We're talking about cultural appropriation.
Right, right.
Which is a systemic thing and very real. And so, yeah, the sense of injustice for me comes from that. It's very hard for me to conflate the two.
Mm-hmm.
Because often when you're confusing interpolation or covering or sampling with appropriation, essentially a lot of the artists who are doing the sampling interpolation are young black artists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the copyright owners are these old English dudes
right.
who are represented by huge corporations
right, right.
who are trying to stop young black creativity from happening. So, but let's talk about cultural appropriation. What that is essentially is appropriation is always a power imbalance,
right?
Right. It's always somebody controls the means of access. Somebody hoards equity, and that mm-hmm. access and equity is not evenly distributed. So, if, for example, I think who was the song who did the original version of Earth Angel? Please don't make a liar out of me.
Yeah, oh, I don't think I know that.
Earth Angel.
if the typing of the keyboard wasn't so loud, I'd look it up.
Oh, the Penguins. Okay, so the Penguins, a black group, put out Earth Angel, right? And then it's covered by a white group, right, from Canada. And I forget their name because they're lost to history. They're not important. But in the moment, they score – they got a higher chart position. I'm sure they sold more records. Mm-hmm. And if that happens over and over and over and over again, mm-hmm. generation after generation, black artists basically not having the kind of access and thus not able to build equity, mm-hmm. It's beyond a serious problem. It's a cultural crime. Hmm. For example, the 1950s, at the beginning of R&B, you saw a rash of these cover songs. Pat Boone, for example, mm-hmm. remade Little Richard. He remade Fats Domino and got higher chart positions and sold more records until it stopped working. Why did it stop working? Because once the mainstream folks, white kids, I guess, heard the original versions, they didn't need Pat Boone anymore, right?
Right.
Similarly, in the 1980s, radio had resegregated over the 1970s due to these sort of crazy demographic-based rigid radio formats.
Urban hip-hop.
That really drove listeners, American listeners, apart. And then there was a video channel, the America's First Video Channel, MTV, that was based on these sort of segregated rock radio playlists. Mm. So the very first day of broadcast for MTV, there were no black artists. There was a rap song, but it was Blondie's rap song, right? And it took another couple of years, and Walter Yetnikoff, the chairman of CBS Records, to twist MTV's arm just to play Michael Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
And MTV truly didn't desegregate until the late 1980s, early 1990s.
Yeah.
That is a crime of generational proportions. And when I talk about the 1980s for black artists, it was really feast or famine.
Yes.
You know the five or six black artists who were huge in the 1980s, and you know them by their first names: Prince, Michael, Lionel, Tina, Whitney, Janet.
Yeah, and that's
right?
It.
But what about Cameo, Gap Band, Midnight Star, Atlantic Star, Zap, Renee and Angela, on and on and on and on and on? A generation of talent blocked from the mainstream because they were quote unquote too black.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could have a white British artist like Robert Palmer remaking a song like Early in the Morning by the Gap Band,
yep,
and being able to get on rock radio and MTV with this song, where the Gap Band, you know, can't
which do
is crazy.
It.
And so that to me is absolutely criminal. It's racketeering is what it is,
yeah,
right? That is a widespread racketeering. But it has nothing to do with interpolation, covering, and sampling.
Except
to the effect that those things may be administered in a way where a white artist version of a song may be more accessible and will commonly be more accessible in many ways than a black artist.
Than a black artist, yeah.
So can I tie this, just basking one point of clarification? So you're saying the practice of sampling and interpolating and copying the song has nothing to do with the cultural appropriation element, right? That's how I'm understanding you?
I feel like to conflate the two is to misunderstand both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Dan Charnas and Carey Jr. II about music and sampling and borrowing and how the evolution of music has changed all of those things over time. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest today is Dan Charnas, a hip-hop historian, journalist, and New York Times bestselling, Penn Award winning author of the biography of Detroiter J. Dilla. We've also got Cary Jr. II, the producer of Created Equal, here in the studio with us. We're talking about music and the way in which borrowing and sampling and re-recording all kind of change the way that we think about artists and music and how they connect to the issues of justice and to our awful history, of course, of discrimination.
Stephen, I just
racism.
Have to say, I'm too here much. Every day, and I get introduced last.
You get introduced last? You want to go first?
I was just, I'm here every day.
You are here every day. all right, so Dan, I want to start this part of the conversation in a really different space. Fast Car, the song that Tracy Chapman wrote, I believe in the 90s, was re-recorded last year by Luke Combs, mm-hmm. who is a country artist who just loved the song and loved the idea of what he could do with it. And then the two of them performed together on stage at the Grammys this year. I thought it was this incredibly moving kind of moment that drew on all kinds of controversy and racial history and just great musical kind of connection. But I think it also rankled a lot of people. And I guess what I want to go back to here is the fact that we have been trained to believe that there is black music and there is white music, and that there are black artists and that there are white artists, and that the segregation that was forced on the music industry is natural. And I thought that was such a great answer to it. That performance, of course, the recording, they were great answers to all of that. And yet we still kind of we don't have everybody on the same page. I mean, there are people who really dug into the idea that this is not the way it should be.
Yeah. I mean, look, first of all, there are a number of different nuances and distortions I think we need to untangle, right? The first is, obviously, you have a younger white artist who is doing a cover version of a song that was created and performed originally by this black female mm-hmm. songwriter. Mm-hmm. Automatically, that is going to bring up this idea. I mean, I remember seeing some things on social media basically saying nobody knew about this earlier version, and suddenly this white artist is redoing it. Like, that
Which
is
not
completely
true.
Ahistorical. Yeah. She got a Grammy for that. She was on the cover of Spin magazine, and like, she was big.
Yeah.
I think the injustice, if we can call it that, is about the fact that there was no space, even in the 80s, 90s music business, for somebody like Tracy Chapman to have a sustained career as a black woman.
Right.
Right?
Right.
There was no Americana space for black women at that time. And that also, I think, has a lot to do with the legacy of Jim Crow, with rigid formatting, with a kind of way that aesthetics are narrowed in commercial spaces. So in order to be a successful black artist in the late 80s, early 1990s, you had to be New Jack Swing
or
hip hop soul. There was very little institutional support, especially in black radio, right, and black media, or black owned and operated or operated media, for somebody like Tracy Chapman. Tracy Chapman wasn't embraced on black radio. She wasn't played on black radio. It just wasn't, just in the same way that Jimi Hendrix in the 60s wasn't really embraced by the black community. And so it puts folks like Hendrix and Chapman in a position of having to rely on either white niche or mainstream outlets that do not have an ecumenical spirit, that do not have enlightenment, that do not have conceptions of blackness that are broad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is nobody did in the very few did in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, there was nowhere for her to go.
And I think one of the things that people love about Beyoncé's album, to kind of bring it back to present day, uh-huh. is that she is presenting in the mainstream eye a broad conception of blackness that actually jives with reality. Mm. I'm married a woman from Detroit who, black woman from Detroit, who grew up listening to Kate Bush.
Right.
Like, folks in Detroit love Kate Bush. Yep. Right. That Detroit in particular had a conception of blackness that was broad. And I think that that's what resonates, for a lot of folks who are listening to this Beyoncé album.
Okay. Dan Charnas, it was really great to have you here for this conversation. I'm going to ask you one more question. Do you like Beyoncé's new album? Are you into it? I mean, everybody I see on social media is got a review, right? An instant review. Some of them just like two or three words. But I'm curious, as somebody who knows as much about music as you do, what you think of this effort.
Oh, I do like it. I think it's brilliant. I mean, I definitely appreciate Beyoncé's genius more than, say, I return again and again to her albums or her mm-hmm. songs as anthems,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I tend to be more of a singles person mm-hmm. with Beyoncé. But I will say I had some slack-jawed moments listening to this album, like when Blackbird came on as the second, I'm like, what?
Right.
What? Does she have Paul McCartney chained to a radiator somewhere in the recording studio? What is going on? No, it's brilliant. She's brilliant. And I always say, look, Beyoncé, actually, even beyond all this, she changed the way that, I don't want to say just women, but she changed the way vocals are sung in American music.
Yes.
She was among the first, if not the first, but certainly the most consistent example of vocalists approaching the cadences in which they sing as MCs would. Right,
yeah.
You listen to Bone Thugs and Harmony in the 1990s, and then you listen to Destiny's Child, and you understand that there's a rhythmic kind of borrowing there that completely changes the way we think of how people sing.
Yeah,
that's hugely important, and Beyoncé will always be important because of that. But just to be an artist in her level, where she could just have a residency in Vegas mm-hmm. and ride off into the sunset, she is still doing these incredible, ambitious albums that she could very well not do, but she's doing them and brilliantly. So I guess the answer is yes, I really like the album.
Yeah.
But we still haven't talked about sampling. What's up with that?
We never got to it.
See, Beyoncé sucks all the oxygen out of the room.
That's right.
All right, Dan, great to have you here in Detroit, and great to have you on Created Equal. Next time you're actually in town, we'll have to get together.
I am so honored always to be in conversation with you all.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dan. So I don't know that I fully am on the same page as Dan with this one, but I do resonate his point about not conflating sampling with cultural appropriation, right?
They're two different things.
They're two different things separately.
Sometimes they travel together.
Right, and that's where I feel like that's probably where my impetus for wanting to talk about it came from. But largely, to insert it into this conversation that, as you said, is about culture, is about our history, may not be the right place.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure it has a home with the conversation about Beyoncé, mm-hmm. but it's not too far afield from it.
Right.
It's related. And because sampling is about ownership,
mm-hmm.
genre is also about ownership, and they both connect through our history. in the way that people have either been honored for the things that they did or had those things stolen, mm-hmm. and they've been completely forgotten. And Beyoncé's album kind of calls on all of that together.
Mm-hmm. And one is social-cultural ownership.
Right.
The other one is legal ownership.
That's right.
That's kind of where I think I might have been conflating the ideas. That's it might be worth – I kind of want to invent – I want to kind of reinvestigate that, though, the cultural appropriation and the – maybe we have to do another episode.
As I say, we can do another episode
about just that.
We can have more conversation. Always have more conversation on Created Equal. That'll do it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org. And, of course, make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carey Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson, and our music is by Sam Bobian.